It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some new buildings in Milwaukee could be required to have solar panels under a proposal from a Milwaukee alderman. The sponsor of that plan joins the show coming up. Now, state and local governments have a long history of offering incentives to convince businesses to set up shop and create jobs in their area. Wisconsin's Foxconn deal upped the ante, giving the Taiwan-based electronics manufacturer $3 billion in state incentives to set up a new factory in the Mount Pleasant area, plus some local incentives, too. And throughout 2018, cities and states, including briefly Wisconsin, have been throwing incentives at e-commerce giant Amazon after the company said it wanted to expand its headquarters outside of Seattle. In the end, Amazon will build in New York and Virginia, plus a new operations facility in Tennessee. But the combined incentives of those three states was less than what Wisconsin offered to Foxconn and would potentially create more jobs and higher incomes. Our next guest is here to help compare the different deals. Danielle Paquette is a business reporter for The Washington Post, focusing on national labor issues. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, compare and contrast a little bit between the Foxconn deal here in Wisconsin and this Amazon story that's been national news. Which one ends up being bigger?
That's right. Well, it turns out, as you hinted at, the Foxconn deal is bigger than everything those three states pitched together for Amazon. You know, what Wisconsin lawmakers proposed to Foxconn was 12 times above the national average for such deals. Whereas, you know, Virginia got a pretty cheap deal, I'm hearing. If you look at these things all laid out, New York usually spends a lot of money. That state alone offered $1.7 billion, a little higher than normal to get those 25,000 jobs. And Tennessee pitched in, a couple hundred thousand dollars for incentives for about 5,000 jobs. But as we can break down in the next few minutes, Foxconn, that level of spending, economists tell me they've never seen it before.
Right. We know here in Wisconsin this is a big deal. But you were talking to economists around the country. This one is really on the map in ways maybe we don't realize being in the middle of it here.
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of awesome conversation around in the econ circles in Wisconsin as well. But there's estimates everywhere, as you might have seen. I'm hearing that for every one of those Foxconn jobs, taxpayers will be paying $200,000. And that's just far, far out there when it comes to subsidies for companies and especially foreign companies.
Now, with this Amazon thing, once they announced this headquarters thing, we want to build a second headquarters outside of Seattle, it was like, you know, Powerball, basically, cities and states hoping to win this Amazon sweepstakes. Can you talk about the competition we've seen in the months since they made that announcement?
That's right. People were reacting as though they had a fever. Everyone was competing for those Amazon offices, and largely because those jobs, they'd be coming in large numbers, and they pay an average salary of $150,000 a year. So the areas that would win those offices, the local officials were saying, they were going to get this massive influx of, you know, a new tax base and a bunch of people who are coming in to spend a lot of money. But you also hear some criticism, like, hey, you're inviting a bunch of high-income residents into our areas that are already crowded. You're going to raise housing costs. You're going to snarl traffic. And you might make inequality even worse because these are not jobs that are going to go to your low-skilled people who might aim to move up the labor ladder. They're going to people who are probably already making about $150,000 a year.
And you hear arguments, actually, that this is an issue that sometimes unites people on the left and the right. You were just saying some of the arguments that maybe people on the more left end of the spectrum might say. And then there are conservatives here in Wisconsin or elsewhere who say, wait a minute, the government shouldn't be in the business of, deciding what businesses open here or not. So has there been that kind of conservative backlash to, say, the Amazon deal?
Oh, absolutely. You hear voices on both sides of the political aisle saying, taxpayers should not be buying jobs. You know, you hear the phrase corporate welfare tossed out there. And so every time a deal like this happens, it's controversial. There's a lot of debate. It's often politicized, depending on who's pushing it. And that's what happened with the Foxconn deal. You had Scott Walker and President Trump unveil that together last year at the White House and say, hey, this is a massive economic victory for the state. And something like that alone is going to inspire a lot of debate.
Now, if you're a politician and you don't get in this game and all of a sudden, say, instead of Wisconsin, Michigan gets Foxconn, or instead of Virginia, I don't know, Maryland gets Amazon, you might look like a loser in that circumstance. People would be looking to you saying, hey, why did you let those jobs slip through your fingers? There's not really a winning solution for that elected official.
That's true. These officials are put in a tough spot. I thought Los Angeles, that California reaction was pretty funny when they lost out on Amazon. People were saying, well, thank goodness. Traffic is already terrible. We don't need this. We really don't. And Maryland ended up offering so much more money. I saw some estimates up to $7 billion for Amazon, but lost out to Virginia, neighbor Virginia, who offered less than $1 billion. So there's also those arguments that this was never actually about subsidies. Amazon was always going to go where the talent was best, and now they have these state sweeteners by making it a contest.
Right. That's the concern, is that there's a limited number of places that Foxconn could do, in part because of their need for fresh water. You need something like a Great Lake nearby. If you're Amazon, you need a certain kind of educated workforce nearby. Is this really just about sort of seeing what you can extort from a government in a place you're probably going to go anyway?
You certainly hear that. You certainly hear that. And Foxconn, those kind of jobs are just much different. Yeah, they needed to be by fresh water, but they're also looking for a workforce who could fill those entry-level assembly jobs. And you had politicians out there saying, hey, a large part of our workforce has always been blue-collar. They've always done this type of work. We're proud of it. We want more of it. We want a bigger manufacturing base, however that might look, and this is the future.
Talking to Daniel Paquette, business reporter for The Washington Post. We're looking at government subsidies, big subsidies for corporations, Foxconn here in Wisconsin, this Amazon deal in New York, Virginia, a little bit in Tennessee, too. Now, an argument, Danielle, for Foxconn here is, okay, we get the payoff in the jobs themselves at Foxconn. There'll be secondary benefits. All their suppliers are going to benefit. A lot of them will be here in Wisconsin. And the hope is this creates a new kind of economy in southeastern Wisconsin. So you have to look beyond the bottom line of what we're paying in and directly getting back out of it. Are people seeing that case as they analyze deals like this?
You know, that Scott Walker, that was his argument all along. We want Wisconsin's own version of Silicon Valley, and Foxconn is going to attract all kinds of other businesses. So far, we're not seeing any evidence of that. They just broke ground in late June, early July, and people in Mount Pleasant, where the site is being based, are really worried that it might not actually attract that level of additional business because the company has already waffled on what exactly it'll be making in that factory. You know, the original deal and the original terms, Foxconn said they were going to be making these really high technology flat screen displays you might find in an iPhone or similar gadgets. Now they're saying they're going to make smaller versions that might require less labor and therefore might require less suppliers and less other people all around. So there's just a lot of uncertainty in that area.
Let's talk about that uncertainty. Are people comparing, okay, Amazon, they're a known quantity in the United States. You kind of know what you're getting out of them for better and worse. Is Foxconn seen as more of a question mark given their track record?
Foxconn is the ultimate question mark, I'm hearing. You know, they've made these promises around the world before. They've met with local officials in the U.S. across the country. There was a pledge a few years back, I believe, in Pennsylvania for a plant that never came to fruition. So people are saying, hey, this might not happen, or it might not happen in the way that we wanted it to happen. And Wisconsin did bake in some protections there, saying, hey, if Foxconn doesn't deliver, they don't get the subsidies. But when you're looking at Amazon, this is a known quantity. You know, there's tons of workers in the U.S. It's an American company. They're just less shadowy in general than Foxconn. We know what we're dealing with.
Is there a question about political fallout? We've seen Republicans in Wisconsin support Foxconn. Governor Walker lost a close election not that long ago. Now we have Democrats in New York, for example. Is there a fear there that, okay, they hype this deal, they sell this deal, they cut through a lot of red tape to make it quickly? Is there fear of political backlash there for them?
Oh, yeah, and there has been in Wisconsin and beyond. I've heard the criticism that Walker sort of hurried that deal through so he'd have a better shot at reelection. He could point at something tangible, an economic victory, and that's how he framed it when he was unveiling the plan with President Trump last year. But a lot of people weren't too happy about all the money going into this and how taxpayers' taxpayers would be additionally burdened. And then you had the Democrats running against him in the midterms. You know, Tony Evers called the deal a Hail Mary pass on the part of the governor.
Now, are people seeing this as kind of an unbalanced playing field? You've got Amazon, which is huge, and there's only one Amazon. You've got Foxconn, this huge global company. There's only one of them in some ways. And they can, the concern, I guess, is that they can play off state and local governments against each other. They can play off countries against each other, for that matter, for where they set up their production facilities or other sites. Are people worried that local governments are outmatched in a deal like this?
Oh, absolutely. I'm hearing that there should be some kind of legal barrier here from critics. They say you're getting these giant rich companies taking advantage of areas that really want to win, or maybe they feel like they're missing out on the best thing for their area. It's being framed as this investment that could support generations of workers to come. So there's just a lot of discussion around this because these deals have happened for a long time. Now they're happening more frequently, and they're much larger.
I want to get your take on this. Let's look at two possible scenarios. One, there's a backlash. People look at these huge deals and say, hold on, we got to back away from this. We can't do these kind of big subsidies anymore. That's A. Or B, it just raises the bar. Oh, well, this huge deal, $3 billion in Foxconn, so by comparison, the next one doesn't look so bad, and we see more mega deals like Foxconn and Amazon.
Oh, I've been talking to an economist who's tracked these incentive packages across the country for 20, 30 years now. And what he told me is this is not something an area, a state, a county, whatever, can do often. You need to pick your target and stick with it because there's just not enough money to pull it off. You're going to really upset people, and it just doesn't make sense economically.
Now, the wacky thing as we wrap up, Danielle, is we're really not going to know how these deals pay off for years, maybe even decades. What do you watch for in the middle term, short to middle term?
That's right. In the short to middle term, all you can really do is just say, hey, is this company following through on its promise? You know, Foxconn so far has broken ground. It started on that plant that it promised would be worth $10 billion. But, you know, you have analysts in Wisconsin, like at the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, that nonpartisan body, who said, this deal, we've done the calculations, and this deal won't pay off at all for taxpayers until at least 2042.
We'll leave it there for now. Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Danielle Paquette is a business reporter for The Washington Post, focusing on national labor issues. She joined us today to compare Wisconsin's Foxconn deal to the subsidies that both New York and Virginia gave to Amazon. Big news over the last week there. Some new buildings under construction in Milwaukee after the start of 2019 could be required to install solar panels under new legislation being proposed in the city. The legislation is being promoted by Alderman Tony Zielinski, who represents Milwaukee's 14th ward that includes the southeastern neighborhood of Bayview. He joins us now to talk about the proposal. Alder Zielinski, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, spell out the basics. What exactly would this solar power rule change in Milwaukee?
Well, the legislation that I am introducing would require that any new developments with three units or less be powered with solar power. However, the actual legislation will be calling upon the state to provide the city with enabling legislation to allow us to do this. And the reason for that is right now, the way the statutes are structured, we're specifically precluded from passing such legislation until such time that the state gives us the enabling authority. And I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to get that support from the state.
What led you to pursue this?
Well, I'm a very environmentally friendly kind of individual and representative of my district. I know that my district is very supportive of renewable energy and alternative sources of energy. And I think, you know, that this is a good, easy way to help accomplish that particular goal. Because if there's a new construction, it's very easy at that particular point in time to put the solar power in as opposed to, you know, installing solar power after, you know, the house is built. And, you know, I mean, there's numerous benefits to going solar. Number one, it helps reduce our reliance on the importation of foreign fossil fuels. Number two, it's great for the environment because instead of emitting foreign fossil fuels into the air, we're able to get the power from the sun, which is clean energy, and that's what we want to do. We want to have a zero carbon, as much of a zero carbon footprint as possible.
Are you inspired are you inspired by similar actions in other communities around the country?
Yeah, actually, I have to be quite frank. I read about this in California, that this is what they're doing statewide in California. And I said, hey, this is really, really a great idea. We need to bring this to Milwaukee. And also, I want to add that there's a third benefit, and that's an employment benefit. Because, you know, the number of jobs that could be created to install these solar panels, would be significant. And these are good-paying jobs. So, you know, I mean, you're at a win-win situation. This is a win-win-win situation with really... no drawback as far as I can see.
Why this particular set of residential buildings of a certain size?
Well, basically, going back to the California model, I figured, hey, I'm not going to reinvent the wheel here. And basically, what I'm pushing in Milwaukee is what they passed in California. So there's still some time before this will come up for a vote. So I'm still going into the rationale for the California legislation.
And one concern people might have is that, okay, I mean, it sounds nice, but adding construction requirements is going to make new housing more expensive. What do you say to them?
Yeah, that's the number one argument that's used historically against initiatives like this, and that it does add to the additional cost. But I think to the average home construction, we're looking at about $10,000. And so I think that, $10,000 added to the cost of a new construction is minimal, especially when you consider the amount of savings that the homeowner will experience due to reduced energy costs. Because, again, you know, as opposed to paying for that energy, you're getting it from the sun. So, you know, there's a time period of maybe 4 or 5 years, whatever. It depends, on a number of variables. But at some point in time, let's say, 5 years, you recoup your money, and thereafter, you're saving money the rest of your life in that particular house. So you're saving money in the long term. You're helping to create jobs. You're helping to reduce the reliance of the importation of foreign fossil fuels. You're helping the environment. So, I can tell you right now, no matter what initiative people advance, there's always going to be some drawback. And the drawback on this one is the initial upfront cost. But I think when people look at all the benefits, the pros versus, the negatives, I think the pros win hands down. And that's why I think this is a great initiative. And that's why I think you'll see more of these types of initiatives, not only in California and Milwaukee and, places like that, but eventually it'll happen all over the country.
Talking to Milwaukee Alderman Tony Zielinski about a plan to require solar panels on new residential construction in the city. The plan, legislation in its early stages right now. Do you see this maybe as a first step toward better energy use, energy efficiency in Milwaukee?
Exactly. I think, that this is just one step in a whole series of steps that we need to undertake to help, improve our environment and gradually reduce our reliance on, fossil fuels. I mean, there's a whole myriad of other initiatives. I know that right now we do have some incentives, and there are some initiatives right now that go towards, renewable energy. For example, if somebody wants to have solar panels installed on their home right now, they can get tax credits right now. The actual purchase of the solar equipment would get no sales tax attached to it. So there's incentives right now already in place. I just think that we need to add more, and I think this is just one step, and there'll be additional steps down the road as well.
Have you been in contact with anyone in the state legislature to try to get the ball rolling on getting that state approval for the city to do this?
Well, we're in the process of, engaging those discussions, and I think that Governor-elect Evers will be a champion of this. And I'd like to work with his office on championing this legislation. I think, between the governor and, some contacts in the state legislature, I think we'll have a good chance.
If it doesn't happen, if you don't get sign off from the state on this, would you be interested in pursuing more of the kind of incentives you were just laying out if you can't have the requirement in place?
Exactly. I think, if the timing isn't right, at this particular point in time to get this legislation approved. There's other things that we can do that I don't think would require enabling legislation. And so I'll visit that issue at that particular point in time. I do know that in my district, because, again, I have a strong proportion of my population that is supportive of renewable energy, we have a public art bus shelter that's powered through renewable energy completely. It's completely off of the grid. And so that's one of the projects that we've engaged in. I think, you know, that there's many other things. We do have a program in place right now with the city of Milwaukee where you can purchase your solar panels in it with a group of other people, thereby reducing your costs for the purchase of the equipment, because obviously you can save a lot more money if you buy in with a group of other people as opposed to just negotiating yourself. So it's called the Solar Shines Program. But there's always room to advance new initiatives and new programs, and the more we do of that kind of thing, the more people that are going to use solar power and the better off everybody will be.
We'll leave it there for now. Alderman Zielinski, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, and thanks for helping to spread the word.
Tony Zielinski is the alderman from Milwaukee's 14th District, which includes the neighborhood of Bayview. He joined us today to talk about a plan that would require smaller residential buildings in the city built in 2019 and later to have solar panels. The proposed legislation would need to get approval from the state to proceed. Getting dinner together on a weeknight can be a tough call sometimes, but if you're a household with two people, you know, there aren't always a lot of recipes geared specifically for you. On today's edition of Food Friday, our next guest has rounded up some of the best recipes for a dining duo in the recently released Cook's Illustrated All-Time Best Dinners for Two. Dan Zuccarello is executive food editor for cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, you give a lot of advice, a lot of recipes, obviously, but let's start with the advice part and talk about shopping for cooking for two. You have some suggestions that you start off with.
Yeah, you know, shopping, I think, is probably one of the primary problems with when it comes to cooking for two. And really, it comes down to leftovers, right? The grocery stores these days, they're really set up to entice people to buy more. There's a lot of produce and ingredients that are sold in bulk. And so for someone who's cooking for two, you're kind of presented with this problem of what do I do with all the leftovers, right? And so we really kind of get the book started by talking about what can you do to avoid the leftovers. Kind of big picture things, we tell people, first of all, get creative in the produce section. There's often an organic vegetable section in most grocery stores these days. And the nice thing about that section is that they often have their vegetables sold loose. So if you need one carrot, it's right there for you. The other, opportunity is farmers markets. A lot of times farmers markets provide the opportunity to kind of pick and choose what you need as you need it. Another way to really kind of avoid leftovers is, get friendly with your salad bar. most grocery stores have a salad bar, and, it's kind of an ideal place to grab the cherry tomatoes that you need for the recipe you're cooking or the shredded cheese that you need in a quick and easy way and not have to buy, a big batch of ingredients. And one other, idea when it comes to buying protein in particular is the butcher section. Instead of simply, going to the meat section and buying maybe a prepackaged pound of ground beef, try going to the butcher counter, and in most cases you're able to get exactly the amount that you need. It might be a little bit more expensive, but we've found that the small difference in price at the butcher counter will definitely overall save you some money because you'll be buying exactly what you need and not wasting it.
Now let's take a step back. At America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Illustrated, you've worked with a lot of recipes over the years. Why did you see a need to have this one focused on cooking for two?
Yeah, we're noticing a larger demographic of people either living by themselves or with one other person. You think about, typical college students. They might be living on their own or with a roommate, young couples, who are just getting started off, who don't have children, or maybe it's parents whose children have kind of moved on to school, or you know they're towards retirement age. Maybe they're living by themselves. There's a wide range of people who find themselves in this situation where you know cooking for two, maybe even just cooking for one, but just want a little bit of leftovers. They find themselves in that situation.
And it seems like you could just say, okay, let's just take the recipe for four and divide by two. But when I look at recipes, sometimes it's like, well, what's a half of three eggs? What's that half an egg? Like, is there a problem sometimes in that conversion of a larger recipe?
Well, that's exactly it. I think, you know, ideally cooking for two would be just cooking by half, you know, but unfortunately it's not really that simple. And so we've spent a lot of time looking at each of the recipes that we've incorporated into the book. And in some cases it is, you know, more straightforward, but like you mentioned, sometimes it's not as easy and you really need to kind of re-engineer the recipe to work when you wanted to serve two. And I think the other big thing is, you know, people still want to eat well, even though they're cooking for less. And so with the book, it was really a focus on high-quality recipes that are interesting, that are delicious, that, you know, are creative. And so that takes some energy as far as tailoring them to be for two people.
Talking to Dan Zuccarello. He's with America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about the new book, The Cook's Illustrated All-Time Best Dinners for Two. And let's get into some recipes now, Dan. You have shared some with us, and we have them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Three recipes for two, actually. And this one is really interesting to me. It's a weeknight beef stew. And usually you think, okay, I'm making a stew. Maybe it's in the crock pot or it's simmering for a long time. This one comes together in an hour. How do you mad scientists at the Test Kitchen make that work?
Yeah, so I love this recipe. One, you mentioned exactly the biggest sell point is that it doesn't take very long to do. But I think it also highlights kind of one of the ways that when you're cooking for two, you got to get kind of creative. And I think the first thing that you'll notice with this recipe is most beef stews start with chuck roast. It's a common cut at the butcher counter. It's tough. You know, it takes a while to cook, but when you cook it for a long period of time, it gets super, super tender, really delicious. Problem is, it takes a long time to cook, and second, most of the time you can't get a small enough portion to cook for two people, so you're left with a lot of leftover meat. So the first question that we had to answer is, how do we make a beef stew and get the right amount of beef for two people? And the answer came to sirloin steak tips. It's a cut from the sirloin, which is, you know, towards the back end of the cow, so it still is, you know, on the tougher side, still has a lot of flavor, and the great thing is you can buy just the amount that you need. I actually really love steak tips on the grill. It's a really great cut just in general. It's really delicious. But we start with the steak tips. We cut them into slightly smaller pieces than you would expect for a beef stew to help the cooking go a little bit faster. But the really interesting thing is because they don't need to cook as long as traditional chuck, what we do is sear the meat at the beginning of the recipe, set it aside, build the base of the stew, traditional ingredients, potatoes, carrots, peas, a really delicious gravy, and then right before serving, stir the brown beef back into the mixture, and then you have your beef stew. And it's, like you said, done in an hour. You know, can't beat that.
Did I see a special guest star in anchovy in this?
Yeah, so this is something, kind of a Test Kitchen a tip that we like to incorporate. Many people have heard of one of the flavor, the senses, umami, right? Anchovy is really high in umami, tomato paste, soy sauce. And so it's a common ingredient that we incorporate into some of our richer dishes. And you might see it and be turned off, you know, what's fish doing in my beef stew? But the truth is, you don't notice the flavor at all, but it does add some really great meaty notes to the beef stew. And especially for a recipe that's cooking so quickly, that little bit really helps.
That is a recipe for weeknight beef stew. It's up on WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll come back, Dan, to a couple other recipes you shared with us. But I want to get to, you've got a page or two devoted to gear, equipment that we want to have around. A lot of it's stuff that most people have around for cooking for any number. This, I got to get some of these. I never know how to say them. Ramekins? Is that right? Ramekins?
Yep, ramekins.
These little single-serving, ceramic things. Talk about those and why they're handy for cooking for two or one, I guess, in particular.
Yeah, so this is kind of like our, I think a lot about casseroles. So when you're cooking for a large group of people, you're typically using, a square casserole dish or a rectangular casserole dish. But when it comes to cooking for two, all of a sudden now that's way too big for you. And so what do you do when you want to make a simple casserole? I'm thinking of chicken pot pie as a great example. How do you make chicken pot pie when it's typically in a casserole dish? And the answer is, you need to look for a smaller casserole dish. And the best solution that we found was a ramekin. It's something that a lot of people have in their house. If you've made chocolate souffle or creme brulee before, you probably have some ramekins. They're definitely widely available either online or at your local, kitchen supply store. And it's a great dish to have because it's oven safe. It's insulated, so it does kind of a similar job to a casserole dish. And now all of a sudden, you can make these casseroles that you really love.
We're talking to Dan Zuccarello, executive food editor for cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. He's with us to share some of Cook's Illustrated all-time best dinners when you're cooking for two. Their new cookbook is called Dinners for Two. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you cooking for two people? What recipes do you like when you're cooking for a pair? Do you have tips for scaling down a bigger recipe or for shopping at a grocery store? Are you an empty nester used to cooking for kids? Now you're cooking for two? Or do you have a big family but you only like one of them? You're just cooking for two anyway. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation about what to make for dinner when there are exactly two at the table. Dan Zuccarello is with us from America's Test Kitchen. He's got recipes from the Cook's Illustrated all-time best dinners for two. You can join in for 800-642-1234. Is this your story? You're always cooking for two. What kind of solutions have you come up with? What are some of your favorite recipes? Do you have suggestions on how you've scaled down recipes or, learned to work with leftovers better? Or do you have questions for Dan about what to do when you're cooking for two? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Remember, we've got a few recipes from Dan at wpr.org/Food Friday. To your calls now, Pam is with us in Madison. Pam, hi there.
Hi. In my experience, the first thing you need to do is downsize your cookware. So you've got a 10-inch skillet and a 1-quart saucepan, and you're not cooking for what the pan will hold. You're automatically shifting your mindset. And like an 8x6 glassware Pyrex thing is good for baking in instead of the 9x13 that you're accustomed to.
Got it. Pam, thanks a lot. Dan, and that's some of your suggestions in gear, having some of that smaller cookware handy.
Well, she has it exactly right. I mean, I would say, a great example is a skillet. Everybody needs a great skillet in their kitchen. And, one of the challenges that, as the caller mentioned, if a traditional skillet is 12 inches, and the problem when you're cooking for two is that with the extra surface area in the skillet, when you're cooking less, all of a sudden now your sauces start to reduce too much. You could have some scorching if you're trying to brown something. And so really what you're looking for is a smaller skillet. 10-inch skillet is great. An 8-inch skillet for certain, applications. You definitely need to think about ways to kind of minimize the size of some of the things that you're using when you're cooking, because, again, when you're cooking less, it definitely impacts the recipe.
Pam, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go now to Mark with us in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thank you for the show. I'm a bachelor. I have been for over 11 years. I buy family packs and repackage them and then freeze them or can them in order to make a 2-serving size. And then I have what I ate for dinner yesterday, I have for lunch today, which saves a lot of time.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that story. By the way, we had a cooking for one segment not that long ago. I don't know if there's a cooking for three if we're going to continue this trend, but you can check that out at WPR.org, Mark. And Dan, that same principle can apply. Okay, you can buy the smaller amount, or if you're going to buy the bigger stuff, have a plan going in like Mark did.
Exactly. And the other thing I like to do when I'm thinking of ways to use up extra ingredients, sometimes, like I mentioned, you want to try to buy just the right amount, but sometimes you don't have a choice. I'm thinking of things at the grocery store like celery, cauliflower, cabbage, those vegetables that you get stuck buying the whole head, right? And so now what do you do when you don't want to make all of that cauliflower for two people? And so you really need to start thinking creatively, what can I do with the other half or quarter of the vegetable? And so, what I like to do is say, for cauliflower, I use half of it if I'm going to roast it for, dinner one night, and then I say, well, I don't want to eat the same type of cauliflower the next night. What can I do? Cauliflower, if you put it into a soup, makes a really great soup. You can cook it down with a little bit of broth and puree it, and now you have a really creamy cauliflower soup. You can actually process the cauliflower in your food processor and then just quickly cook it in a skillet with a little bit of butter or olive oil. It makes a really great alternative to rice, and you can season it with all kinds of spices. So things like that, really kind of thinking, okay, if I'm stuck with some extra ingredients, sure, I can freeze it or keep it in my refrigerator and use it again, but trying to get creative and say, okay, well, I have this. What can I do that's new and interesting and delicious?
Mark, thanks a lot for the suggestions. We'll go now to Gwen with us in Madison. Hi, Gwen.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention that people shouldn't overlook home pressure canning. I'm by myself now. My kids are grown and gone, and I never thought I would can. My family never canned. My mother didn't can. I didn't know how. But if you get a big portion of meat on sale, like a whole piece of pork tenderloin or something, you can cut it up and put it in small jars that are, one or two servings, and home can it. And then when you are hungry and you want something, you can just open it up. It's shelf stable for at least 5 years. It's already cooked. There's no dishes to wash. And,
you can
make soups that way or stews with vegetables.
So you cook the pork, Gwen, and then can it? Do I have this right?
Well, some of the foods are pre-cooked, but according to the National Center for Food Preservation, you can raw pack meats as well.
Oh, okay.
But it has to be pressure canned, not pressure cooked, pressure canned. And you can make some wonderful recipes and have them available just by opening a jar. And so even though you had to buy a larger portion or wanted to buy a larger portion because it was on sale and the price was good, you don't have to eat it right away. You don't have to worry about it getting freezer burned.
Gotcha. Gwen, thanks a lot for calling in. Dan, I don't know if you get into cooking in the cookbook at all, but not bad ideas there.
Pressure canning is a really interesting idea. I think it really goes to this idea of what do you do with what you have left over. And I think, like you said, storing it, you have to be really smart. Being creative, making sure you're freezing things rightly, packing them really tightly so that you don't get a lot of air. I actually really enjoy, I find vacuum sealing really useful when you're trying to store something because it really ensures longevity in storage. Getting really good storage containers for your refrigerator. It definitely plays a part in kind of planning when you're cooking for two because, again, sometimes you just find yourself in these situations where the best planning still leaves you with leftovers.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gwen. We are talking to Dan Zuccarello with America's Test Kitchen looking at the new cookbook, Dinners for Two. Dan, you shared a few recipes. We talked about that weeknight beef stew earlier. This one looks good. A Parmesan and basil stuffed chicken with roasted carrots. We have this at WPR.org/Food Friday. I hear stuffing chicken. I hear complicated. You found a way to make it a little easier. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I think the big thing that really won me over with this recipe is the no mess that it leaves behind. I think when you're cooking for two, the other thing that you are trying to avoid is cleanup. For some reason, when you're cooking for a large group of people, all those dishes somehow seem, less problematic. But when you're cooking for two and you have the same amount of dishes left over, all of a sudden you're like, this is too much. And so one of the options that you could you know, incorporate into your cooking is this idea of sheet pan cooking. You know, everyone has a sheet pan. It's a great vessel for cooking, you know, roasting on, cooking your vegetables. And so what we did here is kind of took that idea and incorporated kind of the classic dinner, right? Roasted chicken and carrots. And to kind of spice things up a little bit, we just made a really easy combination of cream cheese, Parmesan, some fresh basil, mixed it all together. And instead of kind of getting into a complicated technique of, you know, creating this stuffed chicken breast, all we did is really, you know, loosen the skin over the chicken breast and kind of use that as a little pocket to hold the filling. And then the chicken goes on one end of the sheet pan, the carrots go on the other, both go into the oven at the same time. And the great thing is, at the end of the day, all you have to do is throw away the foil that you line the sheet pan with and, you know, wash some dishes.
Sounds fantastic. And yeah, I like that idea of keeping the cleanup simple. Now, I have a challenge for you, Dan. Our producer, Rachel Vasquez, made a recipe from the book, the classic lasagna recipe, but she had to buy a bigger container of ricotta cheese. So she's got this leftover ricotta. With what you were talking about earlier, finding creative ways to use the extra stuff. Any thoughts on what to do with that ricotta?
Yeah, so my first thought is making a dip. I think ricotta actually makes a really great dip. You can just simply add some olive oil, some fresh herbs, and you've got yourself a dip. It also makes a really good filling for, you know, dessert. You can actually just make a great ricotta cheese dip that's sweet. You think of cannoli. Ricotta is a kind of classic component to that. And so you could do kind of like an unfilled cannoli style. You can buy some cookies and just sweeten the ricotta with a little bit of confectioner sugar, some vanilla, and you've got yourself a little dip. Those are two really great ideas. You know, it's really great just stirred right into your pasta if you want to do a creamy tomato sauce, things like that.
All right, great suggestions there. And Dan, quick pep talk. If we're thinking, oh, if I'm only cooking for two, I don't have the whole crew around, it's not worth it. I'll just order in. Give us a pep talk to cook something more creative.
Well, I think that, again, it's this idea that cooking for two doesn't have to be boring. You can still have really great dinners, some really interesting foods, and not, you know, fill your kitchen sink with dirty dishes, not fill your refrigerator and freezer with waste. It's definitely doable. We kind of spell it out in the book, like you mentioned. There's plenty of options from chicken to pork to beef to seafood. We've kind of given you all of those options. It's a really great kind of compilation of recipes that you're going to want to eat.
Dan, it's been fun. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dan Zuccarello, executive food editor for cookbooks at America's Test Kitchen. He was with us on this edition of Food Friday to talk about their new cookbook, The Cook's Illustrated All-Time Best Dinners for Two. You can find actually three recipes. We only talked about two of them. They're at WPR.org/Food Friday. We heard about the weeknight beef stew, a beef stew that comes together in an hour, that Parmesan and basil stuffed chicken with roasted carrots, and bonus recipe, Singapore noodles with shrimp. Check them out, make them, and you can also share your tips, your advice for cooking for two on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's the thing. You like dinosaurs, right? Who doesn't? And you like games? Maybe you do. A lot of people do. How about this? A dinosaur running a game online. It's happening for real, sort of. Sue the Dinosaur. That's that famous T-Rex fossil at the Field Museum in Chicago. Sue the Dinosaur has her own Twitter account. Well, someone's running it anyhow. I don't think it's actually the Field Museum itself, or I think it's not the actual dinosaur fossil typing away while people aren't looking. Now, Sue shares a lot of dinosaur facts and opinions, plus news about Jeff Goldblum on her Twitter feed, and she's been running a game lately of Dungeons & Dragons via Twitter, and there's some dinosaur theme to it. There's a hadrosaur, however you say that. There are puns. One of the main characters is a dinosaur-saurer. Plus, there are characters named after other Chicago museums, Shid for Shedd Aquarium and Adler for Adler Planetarium. It's spelled kind of weird. How does it work? Sue lays out a scene like you and your party walk into a tavern and then sometimes holds a poll with three or four options, and Twitter followers can vote to see what our heroes do next. Dice are rolled action ensued. So, Sue the Dinosaur GMing your favorite role-playing game. Check it out on Twitter. And maybe, I don't know, what would the Wisconsin equivalent be? Old Abe the Eagle maybe can get a Twitter feed and run some games. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.